Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Each year, Australian Catholic University holds one of the major poetry prizes in Australia, sponsored by the Office of the Vice President, led by Father Anthony Casamento. The process of artistic creation, he says, points to the transformative life that offers joy and hope. And joy was the theme for the 2017 prize. Well, in this piece, you'll hear the three winning entries as we speak to one of the Poetry Prize judges, Professor Margot Hillel, Chair of the Academic Board of the Australian Catholic University.
The arts in their widest sense are integral to expression, and poetry comes out of that long tradition, I think, of that. I mean, if you think of somebody like William Blake, who was a deeply spiritual but also a deeply political poet. And it's a kind of transformation, I think, Stephen, from the way that the early church used, stained glass windows, murals on walls to tell story. Then we now use that different form of creative language and as a form of symbolism, of expression of both worldly beauty and spiritual beauty, I think we could say. And the sorts of themes we've been using in these poetry prizes have lent themselves to that. Last year's, for example, was loving kindness. This year is joy, celebration of life, celebration of beauty, celebration of spirituality.
Did you take that broader view of spirituality that says, effectively, any beauty that we see is beauty that reminds us of the Creator, for everything in the end, and in the beginning, in fact, came from Him?
Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that's what the poets would embrace too.
Yeah. So talk to me about the winning poem this year, Charles Snodgrass Ryan, writing to Alice E. Sumner. Who was Charles Snodgrass Ryan?
Yes, interestingly, they don't use his second name in the title.
No.
They don't use that.
That's wise.
For obvious reasons. He was Charles Ryan was a local to Melbourne, surgeon who served at Gallipoli and was honorary surgeon general to the Australian military, returned to Australia and retired with as a major general, and had proposed, as it says in the poem, to Alice Elfrida, as she is, Sumner, whom he married in 1883 in Melbourne.
So Jeff Page has reimagined this letter that might have been written. What's the feature of the poem that made this the winning entry this year?
Well, I think it's a lovely lyrical poem. It has a very strong sense of the voice of the, I mean, of course, it's the poet's imagining, as you say, but a strong sense of voice of a young man thrilled to be in this position of having his proposal just accepted. There's a lovely sense of play in it too, where he makes that little aside about perhaps I almost scared you off by talking about having nine sons.
Yes.
And it's a beautifully constructed poem altogether.
My dearest Alice, let me say how truly chuffed I am that you've agreed to my proposal, made this very day at Brighton. It's been an April afternoon I'm sure we'll both remember. The breeze in off the bay, our families in conversation back behind us on the sand, and both so well disposed. 22 and 29 is not too large a gap. I may have rushed you just a little with all my talk of sons. Nine of them, I heard myself half whisper in your ear. I fear I may have overdone my siege of Plevna amputations, my anecdotes of Erzurum. I pray the nightmares I've acquired do not in time disturb your sleep. I know, like me, you are resilient. I've seen the way you handle horses, your resolute good sense. I know, too, how you've chased down foxes. These past 4 years since my return, I've spent long years considering the woman who might share my life. I talked to you about La Belle Americaine, already on her honeymoon along the Bosporus, and Just Your Age, That Russian Princess, Complete with General. I said how I admired their frankness and directness, their lack of mince and simper. That too is what I find in you, a forthrightness to match my own. No doubt your Sumner line will be of no small use restraining my extravagance. Your Charlie is impetuous, it cannot be denied. It's true, to be a doctor's wife requires a share of hardship. You also must endure the vagaries of patience. I'm writing this tonight, ma chère, on Spring Street at the top of Collins. This corner where I rent the rooms, I'm hoping you will grace within these next few months. My heart says we should press ahead. We are agreed there's little point in stretching out engagements. I see you in your white already, some gusty Melbourne day in June, fearless up the aisle. I see you in these rooms forthwith, mistress of the house and servants, mother of our children. We'll have the bedroom drapes redone and add some furniture to suit our new connubiality. The thoughts I have re that, Cherie, are better chuckled in your ear than boulderized with ink on paper. My sweet Elise Elfrader. Has no one ever called you Elfie? I write this merely to confirm the understanding we have reached this long, slow afternoon at Brighton. Strolling in that steady breeze along a stretch of sand. Our paired lives will, I'm more than sure, enjoy such steadiness. I am, my dear, your ever-loving future husband, Charlie.
Formal, in that Victorian sense, but it's also quite intimate, isn't it? It is a boy, a young man, writing to his girlfriend, now fiancé, and he's just so overwhelmed with the joy of this moment that you can feel him almost being a bit self-deprecating with the chuffed, whereas he wants to sing and dance and shouted from the rooftop.
And before too long, though, we've got reminders of the horror. So he says, I fear I may have overdone my siege of Plevna amputations, my anecdotes of Erizaum. I pray the nightmares I've acquired do not in time disturb your sleep.
Yes, yes. And isn't that poignant?
Yes.
And reminds us without saying it up front that he's a doctor, and they often saw, as you say, the worst of the horrors in battle, but then underlying that still is that care for her that perhaps I shouldn't have talked about them so much, but also there's the freedom in that relationship to be able to talk about things, which is obviously hugely important to him and to presumably the ongoing relationship.
And they wouldn't have known, but so many families wouldn't have known just what generational impact that would have as well.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. Of course, he's talking pre-First World War. Remember, he's proposing in 1883.
Mm.
So he's been to various other battles, but that doesn't in any way negate how horrendous it all was.
It was going to be a difficult life.
He was in the Russia-Turkish campaign and 4 months in the siege of Plevna, which he's mentioning there, and then in Turkish Armenia, and he became a Russian prisoner of war. So it's all there, but subtly and beautifully hinted at, but enough to make you, if you really wanted to follow it up, to go and look up those battles and find out a little bit more about him and also what he faced at that time.
And the poet, Jeff Page, has done a beautiful job of once again throwing us forward with now a sense of wonder about how it turns out. He says in the end, I write this merely to confirm the understanding we've reached this long, slow afternoon at Brighton, strolling in that steady breeze along a stretch of sand. Our paired lives will, I'm more than sure, enjoy such steadiness. I am, my dear, your ever-loving future husband, Charlie.
Yes, yes.
And yet their lives were headed to Gallipoli and beyond.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So they couldn't know in that beauty, and as he says, that long, slow afternoon and the sunshine on Brighton Beach, what was to come. He probably thought once he'd served, you know, in Turkey and so on, that was it. He'd done his bit, and we hoped, I was sure, the world hoped at the time that there would be no further wars of that sort, but little did they know that, what, 30 years down the track, we're facing it all over again. But there again, in that bit you've quoted, that lovely juxtaposition between that kind of Victorian formality that you'd be familiar with when reading Victorian letters and the intimacy of this young couple in their 20s looking forward to a life together.
Margot, the second prize this year went to a poem that really does point to the beauty of God's creation and finds language to use for some extraordinary colours, in this case the colours of lichen.
Yes, it's a very unusual poem, and Professor Chris Wallace Crabb always acts as, or has for the last couple of years, as our finals judge. And he said, perhaps not surprisingly, that he'd never read a poem about lichen before. And it is very unusual. And the way it's constructed, I think, is really amazing. It's sort of listing these characteristics, if you like, of lichen, and seeing the beauty in something that we often just take for granted, don't we, and just walk past, or even find a bit of a nuisance when it grows on our roofs or whatever.
Lichen, 13 points. 1. They know the subtler shades of green and where each one belongs. 2. And some reds, ochre, orange, and something aching towards crimson, all in a single patch. 3. They grow patiently, as little as a hair's breadth a year. 4. And live on bark and stone and brick and soil, and even on a bus abandoned near Jerangamup. 5. Some eat that on which they live, working hollows into stone, making of diet and habitation one thing, a modest economy. 6. They cope with hard things and take on the colonising of a quarry. 7. Some make minute fronds which can lift from bark into air or wrinkle over protrusions. 8. They are sensitive and have been used to measure the pollution that we make. 9. Both gentle and harsh terrains are their home, rainforests and deserts. They live according to their means. It's in the Arctic that they grow most slowly. 10. They have humility. Most live for nothing but rain and air and sunshine. 11. There is, though, no such thing as lichen, which is made of algae and fungi in intimate relationship, and is an image of no self, anatta, the different elements wound together to create the illusion of solidity. 12. And also an image of tolerance, the different forms living as one. 13. In this, they are a comfort.
Really rather a romantic poem, a kind of ode to the beauty of lichen, and little things like they grow patiently, as little as a hair's breadth a year, makes you think, golly, if they've put that much effort into growing, we shouldn't be destroying them. Well, that's how I react. But anyway.
There is, though, no such thing as lichen, which is made of algae and fungi in intimate relationship.
Yes.
And is an image of no self, anatta, the different elements wound together to create the illusion of solidity.
Yes.
And also an image of tolerance, the different forms living as one. In this, they are a comfort. And that's how it ends. It kind of speaks of all kinds of things. You can read something in there about multi-faith, multicultural societies, can't you?
Absolutely.
And that's the beauty of poetry as well. It's got its surface layer of meaning, but you dig just a little deeper, you open your mind just a tiny bit, and it tells you a lot about yourself about others?
Yes, and I think the other beautiful thing about poetry is you can get different things from it at different times when you read it in a different way or a different place or a different mood. Mm. But also the way I read it may not be the same way as you read it. Mm. So it has infinite possibilities.
Well, Margot, how do you read the third winning entry on Botox, Bibles and Baguettes?
This is a lovely title. This one's a bit more playful, really, I think, than the other two. Some would say that drinking leads to dancing. Thou, a jug of wine and a baguette. I mean, that's obviously a play on Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat. But it just is lovely, isn't it? And the idea that the versifier, as she calls it, the poet, his mind's never blank. It's always thinking and offering us new ways of looking at the world, which is what this is doing here. I mean, the idea of putting those three together with that wonderfully alliterative title is quite amazing, I think.
What are the elements of a baguette? The puzzle maker's mind is never blank. The creator scatters crumbs for us to follow. Riddles, he says, are steeped in folklore. Humour is common sense dancing. A punchline is the transport of desire. We tilt towards the object of desire. How many ways can you slice a baguette? The music in words sets them dancing. An empty space creates a teasing blank. Wisdom is found in common folklore. It's a true and canny avenue to follow. A juicy clue entices us to follow a scent that recollects a past desire, while Botox emojis express a blank. Love symbols dwell in folklore. Hunger is piqued by dancing. But a pirouette is not like a baguette. Why is the Bible like a baguette? The begats are born from desire. A poet's path teaches that blank verse has rules we ought to follow. The challenge sets our minds a-dancing. Who is the progenitor of folklore? The pun has many roots in folklore. Double meanings cloak one's desire. Some would say that drinking leads to dancing. Thou, a jug of wine and a baguette. The devil knows what revelry may follow. In tales of love, nature abhors a blank. The versifier's mind is seldom blank. A writing pad has lines that we may follow. Rhymes and rhythms permeate folklore. The beat of a ballad leads to dancing. A conductor's baton is like a baguette. Eating is the outcome of desire. O word nerd, you set our neurons dancing. A jester who's well versed in folklore. How does a baker beget a baguette?
I love that line, the baguettes are born from desire.
Yes.
When you think of that whole, those whole passages in the Bible that are just endless.
There was a lot of baguetting happening.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.